Well, what better time to talk about values and what we value than on Oscar night? The night that Hollywood rewards its own and goes into a veritable festival of mutual backslapping, which is a nice interruption from the mutual backstabbing that goes on for the rest of the year. It's kind of Hollywood's version of Yom Kippur. The Oscars are supposed to reward excellence and maybe tell us something about the values of our society. There's an immediate tension with that because relatively few people vote for the Oscars, and this year in particular, relatively few people saw the films that were nominated for Best Movie. What does that disjuncture say about us and our society? There's always a conflict, particularly, well, not particularly in Unitarian churches, I was going to say, in many churches and religious organizations, between elitist values and real people's values. But the conversations go on at every side of the issue, with some people saying, well, elite is better, and others saying, well, the people have real wisdom. When you look at television ratings and which movies were the top 10 grossing movies, and gross is such a good word in this case, you have to wonder whether popular and culture are oxymorons, but that being up for grabs, it is interesting to me that this year's movies were actually about something. We have met on our Tuesday group and seen and discussed a number of them, and this Tuesday we'll do Brokeback Mountain. And what's significant to me in the Oscars is the fact that these were not the highest grossing movies, that nominated for the best film was not The 40-Year-Old Virgin or whichever number of the Star Wars, this last one was, which was 3, which is actually 6, but anyway, it's the Star Wars were numbered by Enron, so it's a whole other story. They move backwards through time. It's kind of interesting. But the movies were actually wrestled with real things that real people wrestle with in society. You have Brokeback, which wrestles with the issue of what is the price of loving and of lying, and of leading a life that is not your life, is not genuine to you. What's the cost to you? What's the cost to your family, to your mates, to people whom you love, and people who may love you? It's a serious issue. Munich looks at what is the cost of revenge, what are the ethics and the efficacy of violence, of revenge, and where does it end and what does it accomplish? It's not a movie that gives a clear answer, but it's a movie that examines the question and involves people in asking questions themselves, ourselves, about the primary issues with which it wrestles. Crash. Crash is a movie that deals with, using Los Angeles as the microcosm, as of the crashes of culture, of race, of ethnicity, and to a large extent of class, of occupation, of culture, of subculture, of all of the prejudices that every group has and all of the views that every group has that come out of their experiences and what they do and how they generalize the universal from their particular experiences, both good and bad. It uses stereotypes and it shatters stereotypes at the same time, and it doesn't have a clear answer. It talks about how difficult it is for us to get to the reality of real people caught up in a struggle of how are we going to live together? How are we going to find peace and build mutual respect together? These are real issues. You have Capote, a movie that deals with somebody's cynical use of the pain of other people in order to advance his own career, in order to get fame, recognition, money, and the price that he has to pay for, again, living a kind of false life off of the pain of others and exploiting the pain of others. These are real and serious movies dealing with real... Have I left one out?
Yes.
Which one? Good Night and Good Luck. Thank you. For those of you who are new here, I'm not infallible. There's no doctrine of infallibility here. Good Night and Good Luck, another movie that deals with something real. And it deals with McCarthyism, with groupthink, with values that seem to be terribly important and fears that seem to be terribly real, and the terrible things that we do to each other when we are afraid and when we live in a toxic atmosphere that was symbolized by all of the smoke in that movie, in a toxic atmosphere of fear and of hatred. And these are real movies. Perfect movies? Absolutely not. But they wrestle with the sorts of things that we real human beings have to wrestle with. Hate, fear, prejudice, violence, revenge, the strong emotions that rock us, particularly if we keep track of the news and the world in which we live. They're serious. Last week there was an op-ed piece that picked them apart, that tried to show all of the flaws and what was wrong. They're imperfect. But I think that when we are talking about values, we are not talking about succeeding. We're talking about engaging ourselves, our society, and our own kinds of truths. That our values begin with a fearless inventory, a review of how we actually think and feel about the great issues of our day. And it's okay to have opinions. It's okay not to be a complete absolute relativist, as I talked about last week, that we do make judgments about things. I am willing to say that hip-hop and Bach are not on the same level. I'm willing to say, and you can be willing to disagree with me, to say that Walter Cronkite and Bill O'Reilly, well, what are they doing in the same sentence, actually, now that I think about it, that there are standards that we choose and that we have, and they come out of a sense of our own values and our own introspection. It's important not to engage in groupthink and dealing with what we think is popular as opposed to what we believe to be true about how we are. In old days when I used to give coaching to young ministers, one of the things that they were always terrified of was running out of things to talk about. If you pay any attention to the world, that won't happen. And the other thing was they wanted to know how to fill 20 minutes and have everybody like them. You can probably do that a couple of times, but if everybody likes you, you're not saying anything. If you're not taking any chances with the real issues, the cutting-edge issues that cut us, that make us bleed, that make other people bleed, and you're just being safe and walking on eggs, you won't say anything. And it's, I suppose, like faith healing as against surgery. If you don't open yourself up to some of the truths and the difficult truths, but with some with both courage and humility, all you do is fill some nice blah blah time. There is a rabbi friend of mine who makes me crazy. He is really smart. He is really perceptive, and he never says anything. because he has a congregation of about 1,800 people. He has an average attendance. It's only once a month, but it's an average attendance that once a month of around 800 people. And he knows that if he says anything, someone's going to be annoyed. If I don't annoy anybody here today, I haven't done my job. If I annoy the same people week after week, I won't see you again. But I can't live not taking chances on dealing with real things and not taking chances about being wrong, about driving over an intellectual or philosophical cliff, because then I'm just pandering. And I'm bringing myself as an example, not to be commendable, but to say that for all of us, we have the responsibility of coming out of our own truths with some degree of passion and also with a large degree of humility, because the world is a big and complex place, and the issues with which we wrestle are terribly difficult and terribly painful. And one will inevitably offend, be misunderstood. But if we shrink from engagement, if we shrink from contact, if we shrink from wrestling with our own personal truths, we never get to know each other. And maybe even more tragically, we never get to know ourselves. One of the reasons that I don't run out of things to talk about is that I don't run out of things that I don't understand. I don't write columns and sermons about things I'm expert in. I write about the things that are chaotic in my head that I want to try to organize and I want to try to understand. That's my process. There have been issues that I have literally agonized over, knowing that I had to say something or write something, and having to decide, will I take the chance, whether it's in a column or whether it's in a sermon, to alienate people, to annoy people, to have people slam the door on me and walk out? And there have been times when I have had to take that chance and say, yes, this is important. And it is not that I am right. It is that I have to tell my version of the truth. I think that's what the good filmmakers did this last year. I don't have to agree with them, but something came from them that was expressing some kind of truth that went beyond simply, let's get as many people into the seats and sell as much popcorn as possible. Ultimately, our success as human beings, our success as a congregation, as a nation, is, as Mary's reading and Einstein indicated, it's not about your Nielsen ratings. It's not about everything that you have made and how much money you have or how many toys you have when you die. It's about a sense of integrity, of having wrestled with the real stuff in a real way. And that's where truth, as opposed to truthiness, comes from. Many of you were good enough to buy my column in the LA Daily News from Tim for the benefit of the Social Action Committee, the Social Justice Committee. And that was a column that generated a lot of hate mail. And in this hate mail, people questioned my intelligence, my integrity, the marital status of my parents at the time of my conception and birth, my patriotism. I got big challenges about how dare you say anything about hunting, what do you know about hunting, and I don't want to tell you necessarily what I know about hunting, but I know about hunting. I wrote back a respectful letter to every one of the people that wrote me critical mail. I write letters back for fan letters also. What is interesting as a slight aside is the people that write hate mail, their spelling isn't anywhere nearly as good as the people that write fan letters. Now, I'm not going to make this a comment on their intelligence because I can't spell. So, you know, it may just be that one is more passionate when writing hate mail and the typing doesn't quite count as much. It's one of those things from email. But I wrote back each one saying something that I believed to be true and not manipulative. I wrote back, thank you. Thank you for taking the time to read my article. Thank you for taking the time to compose a response. Thank you for caring enough about the issues to be energized, because my opposite is not the person who disagrees with me. My opposite is the person who doesn't care. It's the apathetic that is my adversary. If I can wake somebody up to be good and mad, maybe it'll start a thought process and start a dialogue. It is a complicated world that we are not all going to be on agreement over the great and serious issues. We are not going to be in agreement on how people love, on how people bond, on how different ethnic groups match and mix and merge and separate. We're not going to be in agreement on the words of our hymns. The issue is whether, with passion from our own viewpoint, coming out of our own truths and our own self-examination, and humility that recognizes the character and the humanity and the interests of a different point of view, if not in agreement but in respect, we can build bridges to one another. And my good news today is that every person who wrote me hate mail, whom I sent a respectful letter to, wrote back a respectful letter to me. There was a teaching moment and a moment of content and a moment of contact that begins a process of being together, of working together, of exploring together. Are we all going to go out for coffee on Wednesday? No. Am I converting them to my viewpoint? No. But there was a moment when the epithet changed to respect. And we have so much power in this difficult and complex world, where our instincts might be to blow the horn, to give a one-finger salute, to look down our noses at the idiocy of others and to treat them as if they are stupid at best and evil at worst, and to pull back from that brink and try the bridge. Try the respect. Try to have our truths be able to talk to each other and hear each other. It does me very little good to blare my truth loudly if no one listens. I have to find a way for people to listen. I can take passionate stands off in the desert, screaming in the desert and howling and whirling, but if I want to open up a mind or a heart, I have to find that way in, and it starts with what somebody told me before the first memorial service I ever conducted, where there was a difficult family situation, and the person counseled me when I asked, what should I do in this situation when I've got a spouse and a spouse who had only been a spouse of this person for 10 days and the children in the front row? And this person said to me, tell the truth nicely. Tell the truth nicely. But to tell the truth nicely, we have to have the courage to go inside and find our truths to share with courage, nicely, and with humility.